We are into the ninth chapter today. The Apostle John has been raptured, taken out of history by God, set before the throne, and he is giving us a forecast of what we ourselves will be seeing under similar circumstances. John is in heaven and he is looking down on earth as God begins to bring history to a close. In the apocalypse of Jesus Christ, the unveiling of Jesus Christ, as all things come to fruition in him. We are into the tribulation period, that seven-year period with which God does close history. We are seeing the first of the tribulation judgments, the so-called seal judgments, in which Christ unrolls the seal, the title deed to earth, which he has absentee landlord, is now coming back to claim for his own. These first seals have shown a succession of judgments, including the famous four horsemen of the apocalypse. We're now having opened the seventh seal and heard the great silence in heaven as all of heaven is holding its breath to see what God is going to do next. We have seen that there are three woes that are pronounced by a lone eagle flying across the sky. Woe, 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 indicating that things which have been bad are going to get much worse. The word woe is defined by Webster's as sorrow, calamity, or affliction, and that certainly describes what is about to come. You recall that there have been four assaults so far, all on the environment, by the opening of the seventh seal and the blowing of the first four of the seven trumpet judgments. The first four trumpets have been blown. There have been four judgments pronounced by God on the earth. The first judgment was a judgment on the land. The second, a judgment on the sea. The third, a judgment on the fresh water supply. And the fourth, a judgment on the very heavens itself. As God begins to assault the environment and to undermine the capacity of the world and the universe to sustain life. The next three trumpets which blow are going to signal assaults which God allows to be mounted directly on man himself. We saw at the end of last week's lesson a very interesting and curious thing. The first portion of the book of Revelation is written in the present tense. The portion that deals with future events is written in the past tense. These events with which we are dealing are so certain that it is though they had already happened. Now, let's look for an overview of chapter 9. Now, I do not recommend chapter 9 for late evening reading. Chapter 9 is not a good bedtime exercise. It is G-rated, G standing for God, of course, but it is G-rated because it comes from the Bible. At the same time, I want to tell you ahead of time that what we're going to be dealing with this morning is very intense material. Three woes are pronounced. Woe, woe, woe. Each one of the three woes comes on a different note of the trumpet. The first woe is on the fifth trumpet, second woe on the sixth trumpet, and then the last woe when the seventh trumpet is sounded. Now, we're going to look this morning at the first half of chapter 9, chapter 9, verses 1 through 12, and this is quickly how this is going to shake out. First, an angel falls from heaven with a key. We'll look and see what that means. He opens a pit, and in a gigantic explosion of smoke and fire, uncounted millions of strange and terrible creatures beyond the imaginings of your worst nightmares boil and swarm out of the pit. John then describes these creatures and tells what it is that they do. Now, the chapter 9, verses 1 through 12, and the fifth angel blew his trumpet. I saw a star falling from heaven to earth, and he was given the key of the shaft of the bottomless pit. He opened the shaft of the bottomless pit, and from the shaft rose smoke like the smoke of a great furnace. And the sun and the air were darkened with the smoke from the shaft. Then the smoke from the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any green growth or any tree, but only those of mankind who have not the seal of God upon their foreheads. They were allowed to torture them for 5 months, but not to kill them, and their torture was like the torture of a scorpion when it stings a man. And in those days men will seek death and will not find it. They will long to die, and death will fly from them. In appearance, the locusts were like horses arrayed for battle. On their heads were what looked like crowns of gold, their faces human faces, their hair like women's hair, their teeth like lions' teeth. They had scales like iron breastplates, and the noise of their wings was like the noise of many chariots.
with horses rushing into battle. They have tails like scorpions and stings, and the power of hurting men for 5 months lies in their tails. They have as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek he is called Apollyon. The first woe has passed. Behold, two woes are still to come. Now, we're going to look at this morning from three perspectives, because there are three main lines of interpretation in the commentaries on this passage. The first is the historical perspective, the second is the symbolical perspective, and the third is the literal view. Now, all three of these share some things in common. For example, all three of them recognize that there is something coming from the pit of hell, and therefore the news is going to be very bad. The second is that it involves locusts, and that means judgment. It involves scorpions, and that means great pain. It is directed, third, exclusively against man. And therefore, the full power of all of this is focused, totally, undiminished, on man himself. Now, the first thing I'd like to do is look with you at a brief summary of locusthood. Two commentaries about locusts, one a modern one and one an ancient one. The modern one first. The locusts breed in desert places, invade the cultivated lands for food. They may be about 2 inches in length, a wingspan of 4 to 5 inches, belong to the same family as the grasshopper. They will travel in a column 100 feet deep and as much as 4 miles long. When such a cloud appears, it is as if there had been an eclipse of the sun, and even a great building less than 200 feet away cannot be seen. The destruction they cause is beyond belief. When they have left an area, not a blade of grass is to be seen. The trees are stripped of their bark. The land where they have settled looks as if it had been scorched by an intense prairie fire. Not one single living thing is left when the locust has passed. Their destructiveness can best be appreciated from the fact that it is recorded that in 1866, in a plague of locusts which invaded Algiers, the destruction was so total that 200,000 people perished of famine in the wake of their passing. Then Pliny, an ancient commentator, says this: "The locusts are an emblem of desolation and destruction. No symbol could be more appropriate or striking than this. For one of their most remarkable properties is they devour every green thing in their path. This they do even when what they destroy is not necessarily for their own sustenance. Locusts seem to devour not so much from a ravenous appetite as from a rage for destroying." A rage for destroying. "Destruction, therefore, and not food, is the chief impulse of their devastations." Remember that. Destruction and not food is the chief impulse. "They simply consume everything without predilection: vegetable matter, linens, woolen, silk, leather, even the doors of houses, because they've been known to consume the very varnish of furniture. They reduce everything indiscriminately to shreds." So there's a picture here of total, complete, mass, irreversible, incredible destruction. And that's the first picture that we want to hold. Now, let's look at the historical view of this passage, an ancient historical view and a modern historical view. People are always taking these passages out of Revelation and attempting to apply them to their own times. In the 7th century, which was seen to coincide with the breaking of the seventh seal, people who lived at that time were aware of a fiery prophet who had emerged in the deserts of Arabia. His name, of course, was Muhammad. Muhammad spread word of his God Allah and of his book, the Quran, with the sword, and he had a very simple policy: yield and become a follower of Islam, become a slave and pay tribute, or die. A very simple policy. The logic of attributing this passage to Muhammad and the spread of Islam was, the book of Exodus says that the east wind always brings the locusts. That was what brought the plague of locusts onto Egypt. There was a tradition of Islam that locusts fell out of the sky and into the hand of Muhammad, and written on their wings was an inscription, and the inscription was, "We are the army of Allah," and they proclaimed that. The Arabs, of course, swarmed out of Arabia like a great cloud of locusts, and they covered all of the northern Mediterranean basin over as far, finally, as Spain, where they reached the high watermark of their conquests. And then people looked at all of that, and at this time, compared what was happening in terms of this incredible invasion with these passages. And let me give you just two or three samples to show how they went about justifying that. this passage talks about the locusts looking like horses arrayed for battle. Well, of course, the Arabs were famous horsemen. On their heads, you remember, it says they were what looked like crowns or diadems. That's the turbans that the Arabs wore. It says that they had hair like a woman's hair, and the Arabs did wear long flowing hair at that time, as well as beards. It says the locusts had scales like breastplates, and the Arabs did wear a vest of chain mail. It said they had tails like scorpions. They showed that to be the long curving scimitar which all of the Arabs carried. And finally, they had the power to hurt 5 months. 30 days times 5 months, 150 days. They said that really means years. And it turned out that the high water mark of this Arab conquest was reached at about 150 years after Muhammad began to preach. So from that it was concluded that the passage in Revelation that we're dealing with this morning spoke to this incredible invasion that boiled out of Arabia and covered much of the Mediterranean world. Now there is a parallel modern historical view. There have been many, many others, but just to bracket this for you. And that goes like this. This is a description of combat between modern armies. The locusts are jet airplanes, according to this theory. For example, the crowns of gold, those are not turbans, they are jet aircraft pilot helmets. The woman's hair is the contrails that comes out of the jet as it flies through the atmosphere. Teeth like lion's teeth, that's the rockets under the wings of the aircraft. And understand, this theory holds that John is seeing a vision of things yet to come which he has no knowledge of. He'd never even seen a four-wheel chariot, let alone a jet aircraft. And so he was describing these things in terms of what he knew. The noise of the wings that is spoken of, well, that's the flight that a jet makes when it goes through the sound barrier. Tails that sting, that's the jet blast. It's also bombs. It may be a new and advanced form of laser weapon. Then 5 months that they are allowed to hurt and to sting, well, that's the period of time, 5 or 6 months, that it takes nuclear devastation to subside and for the radiation to dissipate. Now, what are we going to do with this historical approach? Well, I think simply this. God, as we've said before, is the greatest cartoonist in all of history. He teaches with illustrations. He teaches with examples. One of his favorite techniques, I believe, is the historical echo. The historical echo. In the late 1700s, a man arose in Europe who was seen very clearly to be the conquering Antichrist. The man, of course, was Napoleon. Everyone in that time who was looking at this passage said, this has got to be Napoleon. He's spreading all over Europe like a locust. During the 1930s and the early 40s, another man arose in Europe, and he was seen very clearly to be the Antichrist because his hordes also spread out the same way. And that man, of course, was Hitler. Today, the man on whom they're pinning their hopes for fulfillment of this prophecy is the Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, who is doing the same thing in much different terms. This, I believe, is God's way of underlining fundamental principles by which he governs the universe. He would be saying to John in this vision, and therefore to us, making the point this way. Do you remember the plagues that swarmed out of the east and covered the Egyptians? Yes, we remember that. Do you remember how the Arabs swarmed out of Arabia and over all the Mediterranean basin? Yes, we remember that. Well, folks, God would say, that's a tiny preview of what's going to come in the last days. That's a tiny preview of what's coming in the last days. That's the historical view. Let's look now quickly at the symbolic view. A fallen star in the symbolic view is seen as relating to a great false teacher. This great false teacher has a key. It's what Christ calls in one of his discourses, the key to understanding. And he takes that key and he begins to spread false teaching across the entire globe. With that false teaching, men in the last days will be overcome by fantasy and delusion. Smoke, which comes out of the pit, blocks out the light, which, of course, is the light of truth. Now, we can see in our own day how that's working, can't we? We see the spread of the cults, for example, where the Moonies are worshiping a Korean income tax dodger. We see the Hare Krishnas on the street corners with their extraordinary ways. Demonic worship is very much a part of the scene in California and is springing up in some other places. Humanism is the deification of man and the humanizing of God as we attempt to trade places with God in the Humanist Manifesto. However, the most dangerous form of this false teaching, of course, is Christ plus something. Christ plus something. The most subtle and most dangerous form, because Christ plus something equals Jim Jones. See? And so the great internal apostasy that this view holds is that the church itself will decide that Christ is not enough, that it's got to be Christ plus something. All right, in this symbolic view then, to summarize, the locusts are seen as a spiritual plague of the last days. The scorpion is the torment that comes to those who are suckered into believing these evil teachings. That's a quick summary of what the symbolic view looks like as well as the historic view. Now, the literal view. This is the origin of that old locker room expression, all hell breaks loose. Because this is literally and reverently what happens. All hell breaks loose. The star which falls from heaven, if you would look in Isaiah 14:12, it says, Lucifer, the star of the morning, the son of the dawn. Lucifer, having been cast out of heaven, he is given a key. The key we know from Revelations 1:18, Christ says, I have the key to death and to Hades. And this is the key that he has given. Christ himself gives the key to Satan and says to Satan, unlock the pit and get with it. And he does. Now, the shaft of the bottomless pit. Let's look and see what that is. That comes from the Greek word abyssos. Abyssos, from which we get our word abyss. Now, what is the bottomless pit and who or what is in there? A little background, if you were to study some verses from Ezekiel and Isaiah and elsewhere, which we won't have time for this morning, you would bring your own composite view of the history of Satan's fall. And very quickly you'll recall it's this. Satan was Lucifer, the bright and shining one, the morning star, the most talented, the most brilliant, the most energetic, the most beautiful of all of God's created angels. He, in his pride before the creation of the universe, decided he was going to take over from God, and he convinced a third of the angels to join in rebellion with him. God, of course, snuffed the thing out with a snap of his fingers, cast them all out of heaven, and a third of the angels fell with Satan. Now, we know that some of those angels, all of which became demons, came to the earth because Satan and his bunch here on earth have been raising havoc here for quite some time. Their program is to seek to destroy and to corrupt man. However, apparently not all of the angels, the fallen ones that became demons, went to the same place. Jude 1:6 says, And the angels that did not keep their own position, but left their proper dwelling, have been kept by him, that's God, in eternal chains in the nether gloom until the judgment of the great day. Kept in nether gloom in chains until the judgment of the great day. 2 Peter says this, God did not spare them, that's the angels, when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of nether gloom to be kept until the judgment. There is a pit, there is chained there, a particular kind of angel. Now, do you remember the story of the Gadarene swine when Christ went across the Sea of Galilee and the man who was there, he was gashing himself and he commanded the evil spirits to leave him, and the spirits who recognized him said, Oh, man. He said, Put us into the pigs. Do you remember where they didn't want to go? They didn't want to go in the pit. They said, Don't send us into the pit. Whatever you do, don't throw us into the pit, because those guys that are down there are twice as bad as we are. So Christ, taking pity apparently on the demons even, allowed them to go into the swine. The swine rushed over the cliff and drowned themselves. The word that they used there was this same word, abyssos. Do not send us into the abyssos. Now, if you can just let your mind for 10 seconds think about what Satan and the group that he has in the way of demonic forces on the earth have been able to do during the history of man, all of the havoc that has been wreaked, all of the death and the misery and the suffering and destruction that they've been responsible for, imagine what kind of malevolent beings would be responsible for that kind of thing, and they'd magnify that many, many times. You have some small idea that they're not a fraction as bad as the ones that have been chained in hell for this particular purpose by God to be released at this particular time. And I can assure you that many thousands of years of chaining has not improved their dispositions much. Satan is given the key. He is sent down to the pit. He unlocks the key to the pit. Christ directs Satan to free them, and he does. Now, here's what is apparently going to happen at that time. Hundreds of millions of loathsome, gibbering creatures, crazed by thousands of years of prison and torment, are going to erupt in a shrieking, ravening cloud from the very pit of hell. The noise of this demonic explosion is so tremendous that shockwaves race around the globe, shattering windows from Rome to London and beyond. Imagine, if you will, the heart of the world stops beating. Men stare in shock and in disbelief as a foul black cloud of enormous proportions literally blots out the sun. It spreads around the earth and plunges the whole world into darkness. Now, what has happened? Worldwide communications are jammed. Everybody is calling somebody to find out what's going on. Gradually, a picture begins to emerge as fragmentary reports come into the news agencies and to the government bureaus. And I want to share with you a small piece of this fragmentary report, which I've been able to obtain from the script of the 10 o'clock news on that day. And this is the way the news on that day sounds. At 5:36 p.m. Central Standard Time, a huge hole was torn in the earth by a gigantic explosion of undetermined origin. The exact location of this explosion is not known, but it is thought to be someplace in the Middle East. The hole itself is reported to be as wide as the Grand Canyon. The smoke and flames are incredibly soaring 50 to 100,000 feet into the air. Most remarkably, there are increasing reports from all quarters of huge swarms of giant insects pouring out of the smoke and indiscriminately attacking man. These locust-like creatures carry a sting like a scorpion, and one bite causes agonizing and relentless pain. Thousands attach themselves to a single human, gripping clothing and flesh with their jaws while repeatedly stinging the victim with a fury unlike anything ever seen in nature. There are, strangely, no reports of death. The insects attack nothing. Trees, grass, cattle, other animals, nothing but man. His Holiness, the President of the World Federation, has declared an unlimited state of worldwide emergency. The International Science Foundation has issued the following bulletin, quote, "Careful analysis of available evidence has led us to the tentative conclusion that we have absolutely no idea what's going on." The World Assembly of Churches has stated, quote, "These attacks are clearly not related to the recent sudden disappearance of millions of so-called Christians in the so-called rapture, and only the hysterical and superstitious will see any relationship between these attacks and scenes described in the book of Revelation, which has been completely discredited by all serious modern scholars." Now there, the fragmentary report ends because the radio station itself has been invaded by the locust scorpions, and the announcer cannot go on. Let's look through these verses quickly in terms of this literal translation. The locust scorpions form. First, demons must inhabit something. They cannot exist in a disembodied state. They inhabit people. They inhabit pigs. They must possess something. They apparently, in this case, are possessing a mutant form of insect of terrible proportions. Second, they are told not to harm the grass or the trees. Their full destructive power is focused on man alone, but only those who have not the seal of God are going to be attacked. Do you see that? New Christians are exempt. Those are the ones who were not Christians at the time of the rapture, when everybody else was brought out of history and directly into the presence of God. They are those who have been touched by the worldwide ministry of the 144,000 Jewish evangelists whom the Holy Spirit supernaturally raises up. The Christians of the day will not be touched. They have another fate, and you know what the fate is. The fate is to refuse to accept the mark of the beast, and they will be slaughtered and martyred and sent directly also into the presence of God. Then I want to look at three quick verses with you. 9, 5, 6, and 10. You notice that 9, 5 says they were allowed to torture them for 5 months, not to kill them. The torture was like the torture of a scorpion. Torture, 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 repeated 3 times. You ever been stung by a scorpion? I've only been stung by a scorpion 1 time, early this summer. Got it on the finger. Didn't last for very long. That is to say, the hit didn't, because I let him loose quickly. There is some extraordinary activity immediately after being stung by a scorpion. Quite a lot of movement. Some dancing and some shouting, I might add, too. The first thing that I noticed after the immediate pain quit was that my arm began to get numb, and it finally got numb all the way up to the shoulder, and then it would sensation would come back again, and I was pulling for the numbness to return, because when the numbness goes, the pain returns. It comes in succeeding waves. Let me read something to you from Pliny about scorpions. When the scorpion is stung, the place becomes inflamed and hardened. It reddens by tension and is painful by intervals, now being chilly, now burning. The pain soon rises high and rages, sometimes more, sometimes less. A sweating succeeds, attended by shivering and trembling. The extremities of the body become cold. The groin swells. The hair stands on end. That didn't happen to me. I didn't have any. The members become pale, and the skin feels throughout the sensation of pricking as if by needles. The sting of the scorpion becomes the emblem of that which causes acute and dangerous suffering. You see also in this sixth verse, it says, "And in these days men will seek death and not find it. They will long to die, and death will fly from them." And then 10 says, "The power of hurting men lasts for 5 months." Let's look at the three of those together. For 5 months, death is going to take a holiday. It will not be possible for unbelievers to die for 5 months. For 5 months of unceasing, relentless, unremitting pain. 5 months also happens to be the lifespan of the locust. They live from roughly May through September. Did you ever see a movie called The Flying Dutchman with James Mason? He was playing this legendary Dutch captain who couldn't die. Two or three times during the movie, he was either drowned or something fell on him or he was killed. And each time, you would hear him as he lay there, apparently dead, in a disembodied voice saying, "Please let me die, please let me die." And each time he would get up, always wounded, always maimed in whatever condition the body was in, but he could not die. Apparently, this is what's going to happen here. Pain that lasts that long. If you can imagine a scorpion sting, not one, but many, many repeated scorpion stings lasting for 5 months, moment after moment, hour after hour, day and night, for 150 long days, shrieking in agony, wanting to die, and finally deciding to kill yourself and not being able to do that. That is the picture that is painted here. Now I want to ask you a question, because I know what's in you. How can a loving God allow this to happen? If this is true, how can a loving God allow this to happen? I submit two or three things for your consideration as we draw this to a close. First, it is a mercy. It is a mercy that God does not allow suicide, because what the suicide would be moving from is terrible pain to worse pain, because they're moving from hell on earth to hell in hell. And what is being repeated over and over in these passages is, as bad as this is, it's only a tiny foretaste of what it's going to be like in eternal damnation separated from God. It's a great mercy, because death will bring no relief. The only relief that is brought by death during the tribulation period is the relief that is brought to the suffering Christian. Second, having been a small foretaste of hell, just a small foretaste. Third, of course, God is not killing them, because he wants to leave them alive for one more chance to change their minds. A mercy of God that this is being extended. We've all seen in the history book snapshots taken at Buchenwald and Auschwitz and other of the death camps, as in 1945 the Allies overran Poland and other places where the Nazis had the extermination camps. We've seen the stacks of bodies, we've seen the skulls, we've seen the eyewitness reports of the survivors of these terrible, terrible things. What we're looking at here this morning, Christian friends, is a snapshot of the future. If in 1939 the world could have seen snapshots of the future of those death camps, do you think there would have been any different response? Do you think the world would have awakened and done anything differently? I kind of doubt it. Even if we had had that kind of evidence, this is that kind of evidence. This is so certain, God has said, that I speak of it in the past tense. It is going to happen this way. Just as the locusts swarm everywhere, there's going to be no place to hide from the wrath of God. Not on the top of the mountains, not in the bottoms of the seas, not in the deepest valleys. You can't shut yourself up in the bathroom. There's not going to be any place to hide from the wrath of God. Two conclusions from this. For the Christian, there is nothing more important than living a full-time life for Christ. If you will show me your logbook and your checkbook, I'll write your biography. How do you spend your time, and how do you spend your money? Are you really committed to living your life for Christ? See, if this is true, what other life can we commit ourselves to? What other calling can we be called to than is higher than the calling of living a life for Christ? allowing Christ literally to be reborn in our lives and so to allow His healing love to spread through our lives that the light of His life draws others to that light as it must do. The second thing is this. For the non-Christian, are you ready to get serious about doing business with God? If this is true and I were a non-Christian, this would really make me think. I would wonder whether I was really ready to do business with God, and if not, I would examine my excuses pretty carefully. Historical, symbolic, and literal. Historically, could that be what this passage is talking about? Yes, I think it could be, and the reason is this. In every age, God sends signals to awaken people and to show them that these are the kinds of things that are going to be happening as God draws history to a close. They are historical echoes, God teaching us by illustration. Symbolic, yes indeed. There are today and there will be then false teachings that will paralyze the world and will cause these teachings to be spread like a great cloud of locusts across the world. Literal, I'm afraid so. I'm afraid that what this passage says is that God in His infinite mercy and wisdom is literally going to unlock the gates of hell and allow those that have been imprisoned there for thousands of years to erupt into an assault on man of unparalleled misery and pain. The day is coming when all hell is going to break loose. It's more certain than the headlines in yesterday's paper. If God gives you the chance in this coming week, tell somebody about Jesus. Let's thank Him. Father, today we're brought up short by passages like this. It shocks us out of our complacency in the midst of 20th century Houston and the comfort that we all enjoy. These kinds of things aren't thought about or taught about very much. Remind us, Lord, that these come from Your lips, from the lips of that same Jesus who said, "Come unto Me, all ye that are weary and laden, and I will give you rest." Remind us of that, Father, in the coming week. In Jesus' name, amen.